Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze. Today we're continuing our old school, new school series with two makers of fantastic artisanal sheep cheeses. On the line, we have David Major of Vermont Shepherd, who's been making iconic Pyrenees-style sheep cheeses in Vermont since the late 80s. How are you doing, David?
Hi, Greg. I'm doing well.
Thanks for coming on. Representing the new school, we have Veronica Pedraza on the line. She's currently head cheesemaker at Meadowood Farm in Cazenovia, New York. Thanks for talking with us today, Veronica. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It stopped raining here, so I'm super happy.
All right.
So my first question to both of you guys is going to be reminiscent of a question I asked to the goat cheesemakers who were on last week, and they expounded on it quite well, and that is, why sheep? Why sheep, and why is sheep's milk so special? David, you want to go into that for us?
Well, why sheep? Why sheep? In my own particular case, is it's sheep are what I grew up with, and they're very well adapted to the hills of Vermont, where I farm. And then the sheep's milk itself is very rich. It's about twice as rich as cow's milk or goat's milk, and so you get a lot of cheese from a given volume of sheep's milk, twice as much as you do from a given volume of cow's milk or goat's milk.
You said that that's what you grew up with, so you were a shepherd, or you've been around sheep your entire life?
Yeah, my parents had sheep when I was growing up, yes.
On the same farm, or?
Pretty much, you know, on the same road. I now farm used to be two farms when I was growing up, and the northern half of this farm that I farm is where my parents still live and where I grew up, yes.
And you've been at the Vermont Shepherd, I mean, that's your farm, so,
yeah, right. I mean,
and how many sheep have you got over there?
Most summers we milk about 200.
What are the breeds?
The breeds are descendants of the sheep that my folks had, which were Dorset crosses, and then mixed with Tunis, which is a sheep that first came to the country way back when the first settlers came, and it's got a sort of red face and red legs, and Friesian, which is a Northern European dairy breed.
And you make you make one of the most iconic cheeses, artisan cheeses in America, definitely the what I call Vermont Shepherds, but we know now as Verano, one of the most hard to find cheeses at any counter in the U.S. Absolutely, you are very frugal with your stock, which is appreciated by those of us who are lucky enough to get it. And you make a Pyrenees style cheese, and I was wondering if you could tell me what inspired you, or why did you decide to make that type of cheese?
Oh gosh, it was just a happenstance, really. When we first got started, we were trying every cheese under the sun, and including a blue cheese, and the blue cheese didn't turn blue. So but that's what sold the best, and in the local farmers market. And so we sent a sample to Patrick Rantz, English cheesemonger and a fellow who had written a book about French cheeses and about English cheeses,
One of the most expensive cheese books I have ever purchased in my life, the out-of-print book, The History of French Cheeses. And
right.
So it was a windfall. I mean, that's such a particular type of cheese and one of my favorites. That's decidedly old school because that's the one cheese that everybody – I mean, you guys make other cheeses, but that's the one cheese that runs through,
right.
I think, you know – most of the market of artisanal American cheeses. Veronica, how are you? I wanted to ask you the similar type of question. Why sheep for you?
Why sheep? They make the best. That's the best milk for making cheese. It's also the cheeses that I enjoy eating the most.
You make several styles yourself, I remember when you were on your last episode of Cutting the Curd, So You Want to Be a Cheesemaker, you were talking about that you wanted to make cheeses in the style of La Serena and Portuguese-type cheeses, like a Serra Estrella, I imagine. And do you feel that you've achieved that goal, or you're closer to achieving that goal?
I'm not close to achieving that goal. I actually had the farm down the road, vegetable farm, plant some cardoons for me this year because you need the rennet of a thistle flower,
exactly.
Which is not available in this country. So I went with some other cheeses based on recommendations when I spoke with cheesemongers about what kind of cheeses were sort of underrepresented on the counter.
And what were their answers?
Washed rind, soft ripened, a lot of, you know, things in the style of little Piedmont cheeses or cheeses from the Piedmont. You know, I really like eating David's cheese personally.
Everyone does.
But I felt like if I wanted, you know, starting a new brand, there was a lot of aged sheep's milk cheese out there. Not necessarily domestic, but certainly imported. And I couldn't compete with the price of those cheeses on the counter. And, you know, it just seemed like there was a good bit of saturation of that style of product. So it didn't seem like a good something to start with. So, you know, I started making – I have a lot of experience making soft cheese, so
– Well, yeah, you worked for Jasper Hill and the Sweetgrass Dairy in your past. I remember that you said that you had wanted to work with sheep. It's funny. I wanted to ask both of you guys, the goat cheese makers who were on last week really made a point of saying they didn't like sheep as animals, and I thought that was interesting. So I was wondering if you guys could tell me why or if you like the animals that produce this great milk that make your cheeses.
Well, of course I love them. I dream of them. I work with them all day long. And I've lived with them my entire life. And I think the folks who were on the show last week just don't know sheep.
Really? Well, yeah. What they say that the goats have a different kind of personality. Do you find that sheep have a nice personality as well? I know that's
sure.
An odd question.
Absolutely. And the thing about sheep is that everyone calls them sort of slow-witted and they stick together and so on, but they have their own smarts, their own way of being, which in some ways exceeds that of humans and that of goats, and
really?
In other ways not, and you know, they can be appreciated for what they are. And just as an example, in the fall, after we stop milking, we take the sheep, miles away to meadows that are over hill and dale to graze the extra grass before the snow comes of neighbors' fields. So a sheep might want a particular ewe might have gone on a particular woodland trail once in her life before. She will know where to go. And we people would never, having gone once 3 years ago on a woodland trail, would never remember which way to go. And the sheep do because they're built to have this map in their heads of where the best forages are, and that's what they live for. And, you know, that's one example of how being a sheep is something special.
Do you believe that sheep have a photographic memory? Is that what you're telling me?
In that department, absolutely.
Veronica, would you agree with that?
I mean, I don't work with animals very much. I'm not really, to be honest with you, an animal person. I mean, I like dogs, but sheep, goats, cows, the most important thing to me is their milk.
Sure, sure.
I would say that I enjoy being on a farm that has sheep more than being on a farm with goats. When I was at Sweetgrass, we had goats, and they were constantly getting out of their confinements. And sort of wreaking havoc all over the farm. So sheep are kind of easygoing, sort of laid back. They don't really, you know, they go where you put them.
So they're maybe a representative of a more low maintenance human being, maybe than the goats are. The goats are a little bit more free spirited. I just thought it was interesting.
You know, goats are like fraternity boys.
Really?
You know. That's kind of my impression of goats.
Why is that? I think that's just, why is that?
I think they're kind of wild. You know, they always seem to be getting into something that that they, you know, shouldn't be getting into. And I mean, they make the same amount of. I mean, as far as a small ruminant animal is concerned, they make the same amount of milk as a sheep, but you only get half the amount of cheese. So,
well, the yield is always different with smaller animals. I mean, that even I know. But I wanted to ask you guys another question that came up in our series, and it was the question of raw milk versus pasteurized milk. I felt it was interesting. In the first show I did, I had Jos Volto of the Volto Creamery, who makes raw milk washed rind cheeses, and he was my new schooler. And Franklin Peluso was my old schooler who made pasteurized cheeses. The new schooler in my goat's milk also made unpasteurized cheeses, and the old schooler, Judy Shad, had switched to pasteurized cheeses. But here we're different. David, you make only raw milk cheese, correct?
That's correct, with the exception of the ricotta, which, of course, is pasteurized in its making.
Yeah, by nature.
Right, by nature. But you're right. Our basic cheeses are from raw milk.
And you know, Judy spoke about why she switched. And would you ever consider switching?
No.
And why?
I don't think so. I mean, I really appreciate the sort of capturing what's special about the farm, and in that way, and the particular time and place that the sheep are in. So I notice a difference from pasture to pasture on how the milk smells as I pour it into the vat, and how the cheese tastes 4 or 5, 6 months later. And I wouldn't want to lose that. I'm not out to make a cheese that tastes the same year round, even if it's great. I'm out to capture what is special about this particular time and place.
The cultural terroir. Do you feel, Veronica, that by using you gently pasteurize your milk, do you feel that you can still capture the essence of the sheep's milk even though you pasteurize?
I do. I do feel that. I could go into some real technical reasons why I think our cheeses
Please,
taste great,
go on.
Even though they're pasteurized. I mean, they're living a grass-based diet, and you know, the more rumination that goes on in the animal, the longer the amino acid chains that are created, and those amino acid chains are what get cut up in the ripening, in the affinage process.
Yes.
Sheep typically have more small and medium chains, which is why a lot of their cheeses can be piquant in flavor, like think of Pecorino. You know, I think that that still can, that the grass-based diet is really what's the most important thing to creating flavor in cheese. I make a lot of soft cheeses and small format cheeses, so that's one of the reasons I pasteurize. The other reason I chose to make those cheeses was because I don't have a lot of aging space. So, you know,
well, you want to turn it over. You want to be able to turn it over quickly, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just didn't have the luxury of being able to put cheese away for 4, 5, 6 months. So, you know, I needed to make a small format cheese. And the larger cheese that I make, Lorenzo, that ages 4 months, we don't have as many sheep as David, so I have to use several milkings, and I chose to pasteurize that just to have some consistency and some control with not necessarily pathogenic bacteria, but psychotrophic bacteria, which can live in the bulk tank and cause kind of off flavors and general funkiness, but not in a good way.
Yeah. Bad funk is bad funk. We're going to have to take a short break, but we'll be right back, and we're going to talk about some of the challenges between the old school and the new school. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. We've been chatting with David Major of Vermont Shepherd and Veronica Pedraza of Meadowood Farms. As part of the Old School, New School series, I've asked cheesemakers about challenges they've faced, both past and present, producing like their small-scale artisanal cheese. And the regulatory environment around cheese has become a recurring topic in this series. Like this past week, the FDA announced it will not permit American cheesemakers to age their cheeses on wooden boards. And imported cheeses may be subject to similar inspections. Like even though the practice of curing cheese on wood boards has been going on in Europe for like a millennia. And I wanted to get both of your thoughts on this, since like most of America's best cheeses, most celebrated cheeses, are aged on wood, and many of the Europe's oldest and most traditional cheeses and their best cheeses are aged on wood boards as well. So I mean, I want to ask you a question, like, why should we care so much about this issue, and why is the aging of cheese on wooden boards so important? Veronica, you want to expound on that for us?
Well, I mean, I don't age any cheese on wooden boards. I have small format cheeses, so I use stainless steel racks. At Jasper Hill, we age cheese on wooden boards. I know that a lot of people are very upset about this, but I'm kind of just biding my time to see what happens. Because the way I understood this was that this was a clarification on an existing policy that the FDA has. And so I feel like, if this has already been a policy that they've had, people have already been aging cheese on wood, I think that it's going to take a little bit of time probably to implement. And also, I don't know if it's going to – I don't think it's going to stand.
Well, this is part of the 2011 Food Safety Modernization Act, which is a focus on preventing contamination instead of responding to it. David, do you age on wood?
I do, and I consider it very important for the aged natural rind cheese that we make. And the FDA serves an important function and has done – our country a great deal of good over the years in many ways. And however, I think in this case, the policy that they've got it would deserve a little rethinking. Sometimes things are counterintuitive, and
I agree with that.
And in this case, it's kind of like lettuce, for instance. You'd think, well, I'm packaging lettuce and I'm selling it in the supermarket, so I better in order to keep it from rubbing up against the potatoes next door and so on, I better stick it in a bag that is airtight. But you do that, and you're going to have some mushy, crappy, bacteria-filled lettuce in a couple of days. Or get a cut on your finger, and you think, well, I'm going to clean it up. Why don't I seal it up good and tight so there's no other bacteria to get in. Seal it up good and tight with a piece of electrical tape, and you'll get an infection in a matter of hours. Put a Band-Aid on it that breathes and allows water and air to come and go, and you'll have a healed up cut. Well, in this case, the cheese, if I stuck my cheese on stainless steel for 4, 5, 6 months or more, some as long as 2 years, I would get that sort of mushy lettuce-like look that lettuce is if you just leave it in a plastic bag that can't breathe, and it would be no good. And I think it sounds good from a very simplistic, abstract point of view. Well, we don't want any porous surface because it'll harbor bacteria. But in actual fact, what grows on the rind of cheese is a rind that that preserves the cheese and keeps unwanted bacteria from growing, and that rind needs a porous surface like wood in order to be able to grow. So I think that in this case, I would urge the FDA to take another look at this situation, because it really doesn't make sense, and all you have to do is look at the situation in those cheeses that have been made for millennia in Europe to understand that.
Right, and also on top of that, in 2013, the Wisconsin Center for Dairy Research published a paper concluding that wooden boards were safe. They were able to be cleaned, and any sort of pathogens were able to be cleaned off of them. I mean, I agree. The flavor... cheese to me has always been like a sponge; it absorbs flavors around it. But I mean, maybe you know, if you keep a piece of cheese in your refrigerator next to a piece of fish, it's going to smell like that. But if you keep it next to a nice piece of wood that smells like cedar, it's also going to smell like that. And Veronica, I mean, did you experience that at Jasper Hill with the soft cheeses that you made?
Well, I mean, the soft cheeses were not aged on wood. The Cabot Gloss on Cheddar, the Landau,
right.
Bailey Hayes and Blue, those sort of, I don't want to say harder cheeses, but
more mature cheeses
stayed on wood. I think that, you know, science is on the side of cheesemakers on this one, and I think that ultimately what I would like the FDA to do is to say that if you can demonstrate that your product is safe at the time that it leaves your facility, you can do whatever you want. I think that that's the most reasonable thing. They're asking, you know, with the passage of the Food Safety Modernization Act, they're asking us to do a lot of evaluation of our process steps and to do environmental sampling to make sure that pathogens aren't present in our environment to begin with.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that your HACCP plans are required, and you get increased federal regulations and inspections due to that act, correct?
Correct.
I mean, they don't require a HACCP plan. It's recommended. I think that it probably will be required down the road, so I think everybody's kind of just getting on board and doing that. And, you know, there's certainly things that you can do, I guess, to kind of alleviate some of the stress of an FDA inspection, like environmental sampling. So, I mean, I think that if you can demonstrate that you make a safe product, that's what I think would be the nicest,
the most
agreeable and rational thing for everyone to do. Demonstrate that your product is safe, demonstrate that your facility is clean and sanitary, and it doesn't matter if you age on wood, plastic, or stainless steel racks.
Now, why do we feel that this law is being enforced now? David, could you tell me why do you feel this is coming back now when this law has been in the books since 2011?
That's a good question. I know that it's been kind of the folks at the FDA have kind of grumbled about this subject over this subject for a number of months now. And why now? Boy, it beats me.
Me too.
Yeah. Say again?
Me too. That's why I'm asking. I'm wondering myself.
I guess. I mean, I know the FDA sees it as the next frontier. I don't know. I really don't know.
Veronica, what were you going to say?
I know that the FDA visited several facilities in New York State, actually, and I think that there were a few facilities that had to issue recalls because they found Listeria monocytogenes in that facility, and those cheeses happened to be aging on wood.
Right.
I don't know if they found Listeria monocytogenes in the wood. I don't think that getting rid of wood in a facility is going to eliminate Listeria, which is, I think, their main concern. I think they just wanted to... I think that there was some questions on behalf of the New York Department of Agriculture about enforcement of using wooden boards. And so the FDA kind of clarified their stance for the benefit of the Department of Ag in New York State, and that affects everybody.
Yeah, what does it mean for... I have another question for you guys. What does this mean, in your opinion, for imported cheeses that are aged the same way? Or do you have...
I mean, obviously...
I can't imagine a world without Parmigiano and,
right,
and Conte,
right,
in my refrigerator and on my shelves. You know,
no, that would be absurd. And I think it will be the absurdity of the ruling will soon come into focus. I mean, obviously, the FDA, the government, no one wants to put harsher restrictions on food that we make here, and yet still accept food that has less harsh restrictions from elsewhere. And that just makes a completely unfair playing field.
Well, because
and furthermore, you know, those cheeses have been demonstrated to be safe over decades and decades and decades, hundreds of years, and it doesn't make sense when you start looking at it from that standpoint.
No, and you also have name control cheeses of Europe that I mean require these things to be named on to be aged on wooden boards. I'm sorry, we got off topic there for just a second. I want to bring it back, you know, again to the old school versus new school. But I guess America, and this was a theme last week when we talked. I guess we are the new school, all of us here, are we not?
Yeah.
You know, we are the brave new world of everything.
Right.
I just, you know, it just seemed like too important a topic not to talk about.
Sure.
You know, in closing, I want to ask you guys both a quick question. So, David, you know, what's the future for Vermont Shepherds? Are you a family institution? Are you going to be turning it over to the youngsters afterwards? And how's Vermont Shepherds going to be able to make?
I hope so. I mean, between my wife and me, we have five kids, and all of them have expressed some interest, and we'll see how the world turns. But yeah, I hope so. It's certainly things are lively and going great right now. So so we'll see.
So no matter what happens, the Vermont Shepherds is going to remain in the family.
I certainly hope so. Yeah.
And Veronica, what's your take on that? What's your future as one of the best cheesemakers in America? Easily, are you going to stay there? Are you going to leave a legacy at the Meadowood Farms? Or have you?
I hope so. I hope I'm not going anywhere. I want to continue making the cheeses that I've been making. I've expanded to making some cow's milk cheese.
I know. The Jubendale, yeah, that's fantastic. So you're going to stay there until they drag you out, is basically what you're going to say.
I think it's a mutual. I don't think they want to drag me out. So
no, of course not. Well, you just have an interesting your story. Like Dave, like when I was doing this series, the old school to me, like in Europe, I visit a lot of cheesemakers, and there's generational. There's generational cheese making passed down, and that's to me is the old school story. And yours is the new school story. You know, you were a cheesemaker and then a cheesemonger, and now you're a cheesemaker again. And I just think that it's interesting to note. So I like to compare up.
Yeah, and I grew up in Miami, Florida.
Right, a cheesemaking really hub of America. I mean,
a dairy mecca
of America. Absolutely. And you know, David, I know because I'm a New Englander too that there's always been a solid agricultural and dairy community up there in New England. But I wanted to thank you both for being on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you both. Both of you make some of the best cheese in America, and I'm really happy to sell and to be able to eat both. And I want to say to everyone who's listening, please join in our quest to preserve old food ways and old cheesemaking traditions in particular. You know, call your state reps and senators and post to social media with the hashtag Save Our Cheese. Raise awareness of this critical topic. You know, thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Cutting the Curd live on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.